In the Gospel of Mark, which we are walking through in this second year of our liturgical cycle, wonderfully composed, there is a particular event at the midpoint of the Gospel that represents a change, a transition. It's the transfiguration of our Lord upon the mountain. So there's 16 chapters in Mark's Gospel. At the end of the 8th chapter, we have this event of the Lord's transfiguration. His glory is revealed. And at the same time, that's accompanied with his first prediction of his passion, his prophecy about his impending death, but that he will be raised up, that he would rise from the dead. So that marks the turning point in the gospel. The apostles now have clear evidence of who Jesus is, and now they're wrestling less with the identity of Jesus and more with, what does it mean for me to actually be a follower of this Jesus? So as the gospel continues on, we have Jesus repeatedly reminding them of this new revelation, this new teaching. He says, the Son of Man is to be handed over to men. They will kill him. And 3 days after his death, the Son of Man will rise. They know he's referring to himself. It's not a mystery that Jesus is referring to himself as the Son of Man. And yet, it says they do not understand the saying. And they're afraid to question him. Why are they afraid to question him? Well, I wonder if that means that they're afraid that he means what he says, that he does know, in fact, that he will suffer and die, and they don't want that for him. And perhaps, too, they're afraid of what it might mean for those who follow him, if their master and leader is to suffer and die, be put to death. What would that mean for them? So they're afraid. Now, this is a bit of an aside, but this reminds me a little bit of the classical understanding of our human faculties, the intellect and the will and the passions. Because of the fall, because of original sin, whose consequences we are all affected by, the intellect, the will, and the passions are all disturbed in some way. The intellect is darkened. It's difficult for us to grasp the truth. The will, our capacity to choose what is good, is weakened. Even when we know the good thing, sometimes we don't choose it. I know that from experience. Perhaps a few of you do as well. Then we have our passions, our desires. Because of sin, our desires are now disordered. We don't always want or desire the thing that is good for us. And so when it says that the apostles, the disciples of Jesus, did not understand the saying, right, their intellect is darkened, and they were afraid to question him. Their passions were disordered. The very one who can help them, they have a feeling of fear about. And so the will, right, the will doesn't ever act on its own. It's not acting in a vacuum. It needs to ally itself with either our intellect, tell us what's good and what to choose, or with our passions, tell us what we desire. So the will now has lost both of its potential allies. Of course, we want our will to be allied to the intellect. Our passions are very easily deceived, as St. James told us about in our second reading. But here, the will is on its own. So what happens then to these disciples? What do they choose? Well, they don't choose the right way. They don't choose Jesus. Instead, we see that they're choosing power. They're seeking importance. Ambition is driving them. They want attention. They want to gain the esteem of others. And so Jesus, of course, knows the thoughts of their hearts, and he calls them out on it. What were you discussing as we were walking along here? They're silent. They don't want to talk about it. They know there's something wrong. But Jesus, of course, they were talking about who is the greatest, right? So Jesus wants to instruct them. He sits them down, especially the 12 here, and he says, if anyone wishes to be first, he shall be the last of all and the servant of all. Remember, they've just seen Jesus in his glory. They've just seen him transfigured. Peter, James, and John, I'm sure, shared that information with the others. But his greatness is paired with his voluntary suffering for the sake of the world. His desire to become, and his willingness to become, the servant of all, to suffer for our sakes. Just as the prophecies of Isaiah, and for example, the prophecy we heard today from the Book of Wisdom, that they will put the just man to the test, to have proof of his gentleness and try his patience. Right? Of course, Jesus was tested in this way. Jesus was gentle and patient, loved to the end, to the extreme, even despite our mistreating him. So Jesus wants to instruct the apostles that to be truly great is to embrace this path of being the lowest, being the servant, being willing to suffer for the sake of the good of others. Of course, words are often insufficient in educating, so Jesus tries another method here. It says, our gospel says, he takes a child, he places it in their midst, and tells them, whoever receives one child such as this in my name receives me. So imagine, for example, that Jesus were here, Jesus were teaching us. I imagine that we would be very interested to know what he had to say. I imagine that those in the back would be moving closer to make sure that we didn't miss a single word of what Jesus wanted to say. But then let's say he takes a child, small child, below the age of reason, you know, maybe 3 years old, and instead of giving his attention to us, he gives his full attention to this one little child, even though there's so many of us. How would we feel? We might feel cheated by that. We might say, well, that's kind of a waste, Jesus. We don't get many opportunities to hear from you. Right? We would want Jesus' attention. And Jesus, by bringing this child in their midst, the midst of the 12, he's revealing to them this selfish ambition, this desire that we have to be attended to by the Lord. So what is this child meant to teach us, right? The child represents the lowest, right, in that society, one that would have been out of place there at the master's feet. The child is also the one who is defenseless. And yet, perhaps precisely because of that fact, the child has the disposition of receptivity. Necessarily, the child, because of his or her dependence, needs to trust in others, to have confidence in them, that they will provide for them. Because the child can't provide for himself. Children also, as you know, represent taking joy in the small things in life and living in the present moment. So Jesus brings this child to represent all of these things, and he tells them, whoever receives a child receives me. You know, I take that to mean like whoever pays attention to. You know, like the secretary would say, the senator will receive you now. Okay? It's your time for the senator to give you his or her attention. Right? And, as we know, over time we are shaped by, we become like that which we fix our attention on. So what is Jesus saying? He's saying he wants his disciples to be like this child, to fix their attention on it, to be like the child. In other words, right, the problem with the disciples wasn't that they didn't understand the sayings of Jesus. The child wouldn't either. The problem was that they didn't have the childlike confidence to ask him about it. They were afraid of him rather than trusting in him. You know, I saw this very clearly last weekend at my brother's wedding. My other brother has 7 kids, and so the brother who is getting married lives out west, and we don't know many of his friends. My nieces and nephews haven't met any of them. So we're in a room full of many, in a sense, strange people, new people, right? But my 10-year-old nephew, I think, introduced himself to every single person in the room, found out their stories, and everybody knew him by the end of the night. He was without guile, right? He just had total trust in everyone, and they all attended to him, right? They didn't push him away, but they gave him their attention. It was a beautiful, beautiful thing, and I think that's exactly what Jesus is trying to, the symbol that Jesus is trying to awaken in them. You know, we're all like these apostles. We're all afraid of the consequences of really following Jesus. Like if we really gave our undivided yes to him, what it would mean. And no, we don't understand it. We don't know what that would entail. We can't see the future of what it would mean if we really put Jesus first and above all things in our life. But, Jesus is telling us, if we come to him with a childlike heart, the heart that's dependent and receptive, a heart that's ready to live in the present moment, we know that he will provide for us in the moment exactly what we need to follow him. Likewise, hand in hand with this, he says that if we receive, in other words, if we pay attention to the one who is lowly, the one who is helpless, the one who is dependent, then we will know that we have already received Jesus, his grace, and the Father who sent him. We know that his attention is fixed on us, and ours is fixed on him when we attend to the lowly. And so we don't need to seek that attention from worldly ambition, like the apostles are tempted to do. Rather, we attend to the world with the love that the Father has shown us in Jesus Christ. We're afraid to follow Jesus because of the possible consequences. But if we come to him with a childlike heart, we know that he will provide exactly what we need.